You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, and 88.1 KFCF in Fresno.
Good morning, people. You are listening to the Wednesday edition of the Morning Mix, hosted by the Minister of Information, J.R. Today, we have a jam-packed show for you that includes talking to Christoph of No Justice, No BART about tomorrow's upcoming protest in San Francisco at BART. We will also talk to citizen journalist Dave Id of IndieBay.org. We will be talking to medical student Aku Dada about the founding of the Organization of African Doctors. And until then, here's the news.
Good morning. I'm Eileen Alfandari with news headlines for Wednesday, September 7th. California Supreme Court justices had tough questions for opponents of Proposition 8, the state's same-sex marriage ban. The court heard arguments on whether the sponsors of Prop 8 should be allowed to defend the measure before a federal appeals court, since California's governor and attorney general have declined to do so. Christopher Martinez filed this report.
The justices seem to lean towards letting Prop 8 backers defend the measure, and they posed tough questions for opponents of Prop 8, asking whether their position would amount to giving the governor and attorney general the power to veto an initiative by deciding not to defend it in court. Justice Joyce Kennard posed that question to lawyer Theodore Olson.
To agree with you would nullify the great power that the people have reserved to them pertaining to proposing and adopting state constitutional amendments.
The power to propose and enact, which are the words of the California Constitution, have not been nullified. They have not been vetoed. The Attorney General and the Governor are enforcing Proposition 8. Otherwise, my clients would be married today.
The state Supreme Court will issue its ruling sometime in the next 90 days, but that ruling will only be advisory once the federal appeals court takes up the question, perhaps early next year. The appeals court will make its own decision on who has standing to represent the state in the federal Prop 8 challenge, and its decision could let proponents defend the measure in a lawsuit likely to end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Or it could stop the challenge, letting the earlier federal ruling go into effect, legalizing same-sex marriage in California. Either way, it's been a long and convoluted struggle for thousands of same-sex couples. Chris Perry is a plaintiff in the lawsuit challenging Prop 8.
To be honest, in 2004, we were married in that building. We were married in that building, and a few months later, that was revoked. And it was that experience that propelled us to become plaintiffs in this case.
Reporting from the state Supreme Court in San Francisco, I'm Christopher Martinez.
State lawmakers have sent Governor Jerry Brown a bill to ban the sale, trade, or possession of shark fins, considered a delicacy in some Asian cultures. The legislation has divided Asian American lawmakers. It was introduced by Cupertino Democratic Assemblyman Paul Fong, but is opposed by San Francisco State Senator Leland Yee. There is a scramble ahead of Friday's deadline to pass state legislation. Lawmakers gave final approval to a bill that would prohibit California counties or cities from banning circumcision, and they approved legislation that would allow nonprofits to operate state parks, some of which are being closed by state budget cuts. Lawmakers will have to try again on a measure that would short-circuit a costly referendum by Amazon.com. Amazon so far has spent more than $5 million to qualify a ballot measure overturning a law that would require it to begin collecting sales tax immediately. Supporters of the Amazon tax have proposed new legislation that could not be overturned at the ballot box. The Republican presidential candidates meet in debate tonight at the Ronald Reagan Library. Texas Governor Rick Perry will appear with his rivals for the first time since joining the race. He's buoyed by support from Tea Party activists. Mitt Romney was next door in Nevada yesterday, where he unveiled a plan he said would create 11 million new jobs within 4 years. Romney called for lowering corporate taxes and eliminating capital gains taxes for some earners. He said he hoped to further weaken the power of labor unions.
And finally, we're going to say to America's workers that we're going to protect you with the right to a secret ballot, and we're not going to impose unions on you if you don't want to have unions, and we're not going to have money taken out of your paycheck to go into political campaigns you disagree with. We're going to protect America's workers all on day one.
Mitt Romney. A defense attorney says Georgia is preparing a date this month to put to death Troy Anthony Davis, a death row prisoner whose claims of innocence have drawn international support. His defense attorney said a judge signed an order setting an execution date for Davis between September 21st and 28th. It's the fourth time since 2007 that state officials have scheduled Davis to die. Opening statements are scheduled today in the misdemeanor trial of 10 University of California students for disrupting a UC Irvine speech last year by Israel's ambassador. The students and their supporters charge they're being singled out because they're Muslim. They say similar protests on many other college campuses have not led to criminal charges by a county district attorney. In India, a powerful bomb ripped through a crowd waiting to enter a courthouse in the capital, New Delhi. It was the deadliest attack in India's capital in nearly 3 years. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh blamed terrorists.
This is a cowardly act of a terrorist nature. We will deal with it. We will never succumb to the pressure of terrorism. And this is a long war in which all political parties, all the people of India have to stand united so that the scourge of terrorism is crushed.
Across the border in Pakistan, a pair of suicide bombers attacked a top army officer in the city of Quetta. The officer survived, but his wife and at least 22 others were killed. Authorities say a third National Guard member has died from injuries suffered in a rampage at a Nevada IHOP yesterday, bringing the death toll in that attack and that shooting to 5. The Texas Forest Service's massive wildfires near Austin are 30% contained. The fires have destroyed 700 homes, killed 2 people, and blackened about 45 square miles. It's a spare the air day today in the San Francisco Bay Area. Residents are being urged to limit their driving. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny and warm, highs in the 70s to mid 80s around the bay to the 90s in the warmest interior valleys. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, highs 98 to 103 degrees. I'll have more news at 10 on Letters and Politics. Be sure to join us at 6 for the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Eileen Alfandari.
We're back, and today I'm your host on the Wednesday edition of the Morning Mix. I'm the Minister of Information, JR. We're going to be talking to a 21-year-old black medical student on his way back to Cuba about the Latin American School of Medicine and the founding of the Organization of African Doctors. We'll also be talking to citizen journalist Dave Id of IndyBay.org. But first, we're going to talk about the upcoming and ongoing protests of BART. At the end of the show, we will also be opening up the phone lines for your comments, so stay tuned. Our next guest on the Morning Mix is Christoph from No Justice, No BART, who is coming in to give us an update on what's going on with the many demonstrations that are going on BART, in which the mainstream media is trying to turn the commuters against the protesters. How are you, Christoph?
Hi.
Can you tell the people a little bit about No Justice, No BART? What is its history?
So it's a campaign of protests around BART that started in 2009 after Oscar Grant was executed by the BART police. And that campaign's been ongoing. It got, you know, a whole bunch of fresh energy after BART police killed again in July after they shot homeless man known as Charles Hill. It basically, the basic demand of this campaign is to disband the BART police. The idea being that BART should not run its own police department.
Why is that? Why do you guys believe that?
Basically, fundamentally, because they're doing a really bad job. Because they keep killing people. In more detail, it's because they're unable to hold anybody accountable at the police department for anything that they do. They're unable to hold each other accountable. They're unable to tell the truth to the public. And their police are dangerous, and they engage in a number of behaviors that should not be tolerated from anybody.
So you believe that we should interchange them with Oakland police, or what are you, exactly are you saying?
We're not arguing. We're not offering any kind of a solution for BART. We don't think that BART needs to run its own armed police force. as to what would replace an armed police force like that, we don't want to speculate, because our goal is really to get BART to the point where they make that realization. And that, what happens after that, that's really up to, you know, whoever decides to step in with solutions to the problem. Our goal is to get BART to the point where they realize that they don't need to run their own police force and they need to disband it, just basically shut down that police force and figure something else out.
Can you talk a little bit about the recent demonstrations and what's going on right now in the streets now that it's 2 years after the Oscar Grant campaign and, you know, the Charles Hill campaign is taking more center stage? Can you tell the people a little bit about what's going on with the demonstrations around BART that are going on currently?
Sure. Well, there's a bunch of stuff that's going on. One is that people's consciousness has really been raised by Oscar Grant and since Oscar Grant with respect to police brutality and police violence. So a lot of what you're seeing is not just demonstrations against BART, but people coming together, you know, people that are demonstrating against what happened with the Oakland Unified School District, Raheem Brown being murdered, people that are upset about SFPD's shooting of Kenneth Harding. And so a lot of these people are basically joining forces right now. Specifically to BART and what's going on in San Francisco is that a group called Anonymous, which is apparently a loosely affiliated hacker organization that's international, started calling demonstrations after BART shut off the phone service to try to stop a demonstration that they thought was planned by No Justice, No BART. So BART decided that they were going to pull the plug on their cell phone antennas underground. And having done so, ignited this firestorm in the media of people who were upset that they thought they had the legal right to do that, and that tactic was appropriate in order to stop people from exercising their right to assemble and to speak.
What's the people's position?
The people's position is that we don't need permission from BART. We don't need to ask for permission from BART. So as far as weighing in on that, we're not going to ask BART for permission to protest. We're not going to ask BART for permission to speak. And we're not going to ask BART for permission to, you know, make public transit serve the people. That's our position. As for the cell phone shutdown, I do believe that that is unconstitutional. I do believe it violates a bunch of other laws. And it seems like most people in the United States agree with that position as well. But I do think it's important to say that BART shut down these cell phones in order to stop a protest. It's not going to stop the protests. It's telling that BART thinks that it has the right, that these, you know, that the staff, the administrators, and the directors of BART think that they have the right to really stomp all over people's free speech and do whatever they want to try to fight these protests.
What do you think about the mainstream media trying to pit commuters against the protesters?
You know, it's an interesting thing that the mainstream media does. It's kind of a function of the mainstream media. Whenever you start doing something that's successful, what you end up seeing in terms of successful protest against injustice, what you end up seeing is the mainstream media starts to vilify you. What I would say is it's really interesting to count the number of stories that I've seen where the media is interviewing commuters who are upset or inconvenienced by these protests, and I haven't once seen the mainstream media interview a person from the homeless community. I've never once seen the media interview a person, you know, a young person of color, to ask them what they thought about what happened to Oscar Grant. You know, what do people from your community think about how the BART police behave towards people from your community? So I think that it's clear who the media cares about. The media doesn't care about, you know, people who are homeless. The mainstream media, I should say, doesn't care about young people of color. And that, you know, it's part of the reason why the BART police can get away with the kinds of things that they get away with.
On a more positive note, where can you point people to get information or accurate information and the people's positions on different campaigns, particularly that are coming from No Justice, No BART and other campaigns that you and other collectives are affiliated with?
Well, I think programs like this. I think there's the SF Bayview. IndieBay.org have excellent coverage of these issues. We have our own blog spot called that's No Justice, No BART, all one word, .blogspot.com. Yeah, I mean, there's also Twitter, which is something that Anonymous has been using a lot. And I think you can get a lot of good information on Twitter, generally through links that people post to Twitter if you look for particular hashtags, but that's what I would recommend.
What do you think about the police, the anti-police terrorism movement that is coming out of the Bay Area so strong since the killing of Oscar Grant, but was starting up right around here at KPFA with the beating of Nadra Foster? It was starting with, it started brewing with the murder of Gary King and Anita Gay, but it really came to a climax with Oscar Grant. Where do you think it is going now?
Well, first I'll say I hope it didn't come to a climax with Oscar Grant, because these murders are still happening, and I think the response needs to be amplified in general. I really hope that it's becoming part of people's general political consciousness in the Bay Area, so that when these incidents happen, people know already that they have to respond, know already what their response is going to be, and just mobilize almost immediately and get out in the street. When Kenneth Harding was killed by SFPD, there were, you know, three demonstrations that happened within a week around that shooting. You know, that's the kind of thing that should be happening. There should be an immediate response anytime somebody is killed, anytime somebody's brutalized by the police with no just cause. There should be, you know, a significant, a substantial response, if not an uprising from people. And I think we're getting to the point where people are starting to accept that that's going to happen and that those responses are going to get amplified in the Bay Area. And I think, anyway, so I'm very positive on it as a whole, because I see that developing. You know, the specific tactics that people are going to take are not so much of a concern to me as the fact that, you know, we're no longer asking if we're going to protest. It's now a question of how.
What do you think about the progress of coalition politics in the Bay Area within this anti-police terrorism movement?
Well, that's actually an interesting question, because I'm not so sure that we've made too much progress there right now. I mean, I think people are still trying to figure out how to work together, but to me it feels like most of the organizations that have been doing left political work in the Bay Area are somewhat behind the ball on this one. And one of the things that happens is when you get these responses, people are going out in the street. Like, for example, Anonymous, you know, called this demonstration around BART in the city and got 200 people. Anonymous is not a Bay Area organization. They just made a call. And when people are in the street and other people see other people in the street and they know what it's about, they, you know, they step up. And that's something that's happening from like a grassroots level. And it doesn't really have, you know, roots in existing established organizations. And so the whole question of coalition building around it is a tough one, because, you know, the groups that exist should be getting together and should be supporting this and should be building this and helping it. But for the time being, they're kind of, I mean, and, you know, I say this as someone who works with groups like this all the time, we're kind of ancillary to it. You know, this uprising is happening, and we've got to figure out a good way to support it. We've got to figure out a good way to build it bigger. And that isn't happening yet.
For those that are just tuning in, you are listening to the Minister of Information on The Morning Mix, and we are talking to Christoph of No Justice, No BART. We're talking about the demonstrations. Don't you guys have something lined up for today, Wednesday?
Well, so we do have something lined up for tomorrow, actually. Tomorrow there's going to be a demonstration at Embarcadero BART station, and we're asking people to show up to that BART station. We're going to be demonstrating in front of the fare gates, and provided that the BART police do not shut down that station, we'll remain outside of those gates. But we're going to try to pack that station so full that people can ride free at that station. So that actually happened at a previous demonstration that we did, where we managed to get enough people there. What BART did was it just opened the emergency fare gates and people rode for free. Provided that doesn't happen, then what the demonstration will probably end up doing will be to move from station to station as we have in the past and try to basically get in and protest on the platform. And that's something that's really going to be up to BART. BART's going to be able to decide whether or not they want to see the kind of demonstration where the train's running and service is running, or they want to see the kind of demonstration that they've seen in the past where service is disrupted because of the decisions that they've made.
Rhino, can you tell people how to get more information on No Justice, No BART, or how to show solidarity with No Justice, No BART?
There's two groups on Facebook. One's called Demand Justice for Oscar Grant, and the other one is, I believe it's just facebook.com/NoBARTPolice, and that is a page you can like, which is dedicated to closing the BART Police Department. You can also follow us on Twitter at No Justice, No BART, one word, or you can find us at that blogspot that I mentioned, nojusticenobart.blogspot.com.
Thank you for being with us, Christoph.
Thank you.
The Oscar Grant Committee is having a public forum on Tuesday, September 13th at 7 p.m. at 6501 Telegraph at the Neeble Proctor Library. It will be on police terror with a panel including Carrie Downs, who is the father of James Rivera, murdered by Stockton police last year, Lori Davis, who has been on the show, along with Sean Gillis, who has also been on the show, the whistleblower regarding the Oscar Grant case. He's the pediatrician, or not pediatrician, he's the doctor who or the ambulance, the EMT, who came to investigate what was done to Oscar Grant. It will also include Verbena of the Redwood Cop Watch about Martin Cotton being killed by Eureka Popo, or police. Today is also the 15th anniversary of the shooting of Tupac Shakur. So I think that we should keep all of these people in our thoughts. You are still listening to The Morning Mix. Our next guest is Dave Id, a journalist with Indie Bay Media. Dave Id, what's up?
Hi, how you doing, JR?
I'm good. Well, tell the people who may not know a little bit about Indie Bay Media. Who is Indie Bay? How did it start? And what does it represent today?
Well, in 1999, there was the demonstrations at the WTO that shut that down in Seattle, and activists at that time were already figuring out that the corporate media was not doing a good job of telling our story. So they put together a convergence center where anyone who wanted to could come and bring in their photos, their video. There was computers set up for free that people could use and post their own stories. And that's the first indie media website was in Seattle, based around the WTO protest. From there, it pretty much exploded. There was one started in D.C., L.A., San Francisco, Bay Area one. That's indiebay.org, was set up within a year of that. And so we've been going for 10 years now. The primary idea is that, you know, activists, journalists, anyone with a story to tell related to social justice can post their own stories. It's unfiltered and open publishing.
How did you get involved with Indie Bay Media?
Well, I started following Indie Bay myself really closely in 2003 during a lot of the anti-war protest. I actually found it to be some of the best coverage out there. The Chronicle and, you know, other, a lot of news sources like that just really weren't covering what was happening and anti-war activist perspectives. After watching the site for 6 months to maybe close to a year, I just started coming to meetings. I had already done journalistic work before, but not with Indie Bay per se.
Why is Indie Bay a needed platform, and why do you feel that this is more needed than, say, corporate media?
We allow unpopular views to be expressed. A lot of, I can't go into details, but, you know, recent history is, you know, we frequently get cease and desist letters from various lawyers that don't like some of the stories that are being told on the website. We, you know, with the help of the ACLU or the EFF or, you know, other civil rights attorneys will help us out pro bono because we run on a shoestring budget. And, you know, and we'll fight those. But in some of these recent cases, Google, Flickr, YouTube have gotten the same cease and desist letters that weren't actually even legal and up to snuff as far as the protections of the law out there. And they'll just pull the content. They just decide it's easier just to pull the content. You can go to some of the stories on IndieBay around some of these cease and desists. And if you look on Google, you'll see at the very bottom of the Google page, it'll say, you know, two or three search entries have been deleted. And so they'll just take it down. And, you know, an independent voices very easily get silenced. It doesn't even have to be a meritorious legal claim.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the stories you have been covering as of recently?
Largely, I've been covering issues related to police violence. I've covered Raheem Brown. There's been some protest at the Oakland Unified School District headquarters.
Well, who is Raheem Brown for those of us who may not know?
Okay, Raheem Brown was murdered by a OUSD police officer.
That's Oakland Unified School District, for those of you who don't know what that means.
Yes, and he was shot as he sat in a car. Was no threat to anybody by this officer named Bott, I think is the way you pronounce it, B-H-A-T-T. And they've tried to say, oh, he was threatening them with a screwdriver. The story just doesn't make any sense. But, you know, nobody else was there. Well, he had a female friend with him who they've tried to intimidate. But nobody else of authority was there, so the officer's gotten away with it. And sadly, about a week ago, after a scandal with a racist scandal came up with the current chief, well, he's not the current chief, he resigned a week ago, but they promoted Bott to fill this other racist position as the chief of police at OUSD. So there's a lot going on there, and, you know, activists are definitely very upset. As well as the family, they've been going to these school board meetings for months since he was killed in January, and the school board just sort of sits there and rolls their eyes or looks up. They act like they're bored or annoyed. And then Tony Smith, the superintendent of Oakland Schools, appointed Bott to be the chief, knowing full well Bott's history and the community's anger about him still being on the force.
So how has your coverage differed from the coverage of, say, mainstream media dealing with this issue specifically?
Well, the mainstream media, you know, they won't cover things in depth. You know, if anything, they've largely ignored the story. After Bott was promoted, they did actually come to the OUSD meeting and cover it. But they'll give, you know, activists, family members might get a soundbite, you know, but then they'll also talk to the school board and get their side, you know, and that's their view of balance. You know, it doesn't matter that one side is right and one side is clearly wrong. You know, they have this false sense of objectivity that they try to portray. And I let people speak for themselves. You know, I did, maybe a 10-minute interview with Lori Davis, Raheem Brown's mother, and Ann Wales, local Oakland civil rights attorney. And, you know, and they get to speak for themselves for 10 minutes. So people get to come to Indy Bay and really hear what the people, the players involved, what they have to say about things.
For those of you who are just tuning in, we are on the Morning Mix. This is the Minister of Information, and I am talking to Dave Eid, a reporter and journalist with Indy Bay Media, as we talk about the history of the organization and what it's up to today. Dave, can you talk a little bit about some of the other stories that you've been involved in? I know that I've been looking at some of your coverage around some of the BART demonstrations. Can you tell us a little bit about why people are protesting BART at this current time?
BART's been feeling the heat on and off for the last 2.5 years since Johannes Messerly shot Oscar Grant in the back. You know, you can go to indybay.org/OscarGrant, all lowercase, and find a year and a half's worth of history on the case, including court documents and all sorts of things that you just won't find anywhere else. It's a pretty remarkable archive, and it's not just my coverage. A lot of people have contributed to it. In July 3rd, another BART officer killed another man at Civic Center Station, and of course, you know, it looks like he's going to get off. Apparently, he has left the BART police force and is going to be working for the FBI. So they're, in a sense, they're all in it together.
What's his name?
I forget the officer's name offhand right now. I'm sorry. Charles Hill was the one who was murdered. The officer's name doesn't come to mind right at the moment.
If people would like to get more information on Indy Bay and how they could be citizen journalists, or if they would just like to get raw, authentic, non-corporatized for the people, by the people type of media. How do they do both of those things?
As I said before, anybody is welcome to publish. If you go to indiebay.org, at the top of the page, you'll see a link that it says publish. If you click on that, you come to a little form with you put a summary in there, you put the body text, and you can tell your own story. If you're a little bit more sophisticated, you can do uploads. You can do photographs, audio, video. A lot of people really kind of build their journalistic chops by using IndieBay. You know, you might be a little rough around the edges as you start, and then, you know, as you figure things out, you can, you know, get a little more sophisticated with video or what have you. You don't need to have an expensive camera. It's open to anyone. And if you just want to go to a social justice event and write about what you heard, you're welcome to do that as well. You know, there's no sort of, you know, you don't have to have any J school credentials or anything of that sort. You know, if you have a story to tell, you're welcome to come to IndieBay and tell it, as long as it's, you know, social justice oriented.
You were just listening to the voice of citizen journalist of IndieBay Media, Dave Eid, right here on the Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, JR. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, JR. I appreciate it.
I Wonder If Heaven Got a Ghetto. That was a commemoration to Tupac Shakur, who was shot on this day in Las Vegas at a Mike Tyson boxing match in Las Vegas. He died on September 13th, 1996. You are still listening to the Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, JR, and we still have some tickets to give away. So if you would like to go see S.Dot Venom and female rap extraordinaire Jean Grey tonight at the New Parish in downtown Oakland at 9 p.m. You can call in right now. We're giving away five pairs of tickets, starting with caller number four, so that we can even it out for you guys that have KPFA on speed dial. The phone number is 510-848-4425. Now, as we are approaching the 50th anniversary of the sanctions on Cuba, we're going to bring our next guest into the studio. Our next guest is Abeku Dada. He's the founder of the Organization of African Doctors, and he's also a third-year student at the Latin American School of Medicine based in Cuba. How are you, bro?
How you doing, brother? How you doing? I'm doing good.
Well, before we get into the Organization of African Doctors, can you tell the people who may not know, what is the Latin American School of Medicine and what is its history?
Okay, well, the Latin American School of Medicine is one of many medical schools in Cuba where there's free education and free health care, and all medical schools are free in Cuba. This medical school was an answer to Hurricane Mitch that basically destroyed Haiti, destroyed Honduras, and destroyed Guatemala. Fidel formed this school and invited students from Guatemala and Haiti and Honduras to come study here at this school and return home to their communities. to help serve in the community, and they also sent doctors that graduated from the school. But the school was originally a response to Hurricane Mitch.
What year?
In 2001, many, I think maybe 20 or 30 U.S. students were invited to study at the school. Fidel came to the United States and made a speech and invited U.S. students to come to the school and study medicine for free. So they did, and we had our first graduating class in 2006. We have 116 graduates already, and we have currently approximately 150 United States citizens studying at Latin American School of Medicine today. This school is a and they call it the Latin American School of Medicine, but I think that it's not an accurate or precise name because there are more than 70 countries in this school. So I think the more precise name or more accurate name would be the International School of Medicine. We have students from all over Latin America, from Mexico to Panama. We have Brazil, we have Suriname, we have Caribbean Islands, from Jamaica to St. Lucia down to Grenada. There's 17 African countries in this school. We have, for example, Sao Tome, African countries I've never heard of, Comoros, Cabo Verde, Seychelles, all of those African countries. I never heard of them, but they're in this school. We also have common ones that are more popular, like Ethiopia, Kenya, Lesotho, Angola, Ghana, Guinea-Conakry, Guinea-Bissau. There are Arabic countries there. That we have Palestine there. We have Oman there. Cyprus there. Europe country. And we have Pacific Islands there. The Pacific Islands are even there. We have Tuvalu, Vanuatu. We have Solomon Islands, Fiji. Many. So also North Korea is there. China is there. So it's an international school of medicine. And basically these students come from their home, study medicine for free, and return the human resource, their self, back to the community and serve in the community.
Can you tell us how you got interested in the Latin American School of Medicine, and how did you join up with him?
Well, here in the United States, we have a person named Lucius Walker. He's like the Cuban ambassador. Well, I'll take you back a little bit before that. In elementary school, I remember my father always taking me to the library, and we would read about Pluto and Uranus and Saturn, and I developed a love for science, an early love for science, and I always excelled in math and science. So I knew I wanted to help my people using math or using science. So I got to school, and I was in high school, and I always heard my daddy tell college students, or even other high school students, you can study medicine for free. And I heard it a million times. I heard him tell a million people. So when I graduated from high school, and they asked me what college I'm going to, I said, hey, I might go to the Latin American School of Medicine. It's a full scholarship program. It's free. And I think I may have to benefit from this opportunity. And that's what I did. I went down there to check it out with intentions just to, you know, see if I like it. If I don't like it, I'm coming back. You know, but I'm doing my third year now down there. I did 1 year of Spanish, and I'm starting my second year of medical school. So I heard about it. First time I heard about it was from my father, just as a youngster, walking around and hearing him speak at Morehouse, all over the nation, in Alabama, always telling students at Albany State. He tells students, I give out full scholarships if you want to study medicine free in Cuba. But it seems so surreal. So nobody really benefited. Nobody really took advantage of it, you know. But I took advantage of it, and a lot of the students down there, my father recruited them. And that's how I heard about it.
What has your experience been like there?
Oh, man, you know, it's a whole different language. The national language in Cuba is Spanish. But in my school, like I said, there are 70 different countries. So I am learning many different languages. It was mandatory that I learn Spanish. But, for example, my friends, they speak Dutch, my friend from Haiti, my best friend from Haiti, he speaks French. I have friends from Guinea. They speak Susu and Walla. I mean, and Walla. I learned a little bit of Mandingo. I have friends from Guinea. Not from Guinea, from Kenya. I've been learning a little bit of Swahili just being around them, you know. So I've been learning a lot of languages. It's been I have learned a lot of geography. I never knew a seashell. I never knew Africa had a country called Seychelles. I never knew Africa had a country called Comoros. I never knew Africa had a country called São Tomé and Príncipe. I never knew about Western Sahara in Africa. The experience, oh my God, the learning the revolutionary music. I mean, revolutionary medicine. The music, you know, I'm learning new music, learning music. What music do the people in the Caribbean Islands listen to? What music do the people in Cuba listen to, which is in the Caribbean Islands? What music do the people in Africa listen to? What music do the people in Pacific Islands listen to? What do they eat? You know, just going to a Pacific Island party and eating with them, you know,
as they cook. That's dope. Well, can you tell us a little bit about the organization in which you helped found, which is called the Organization of African Doctors, which I take is named kind of after the Organization of African Unity, as well as the Organization of African American Unity, which was founded by Malcolm X.
Mm-hmm. The Organization of African Doctors is a group of students, of medical students and doctors. It was founded in 2009. When we arrived to this school, it was only 30 countries in the school. And the population of countries in the school rose by 40 countries in 2 weeks. And majority of these countries with African people, Caribbean Islands, Africa. So we said, hey, let's get organized, like Kwame Ture said, like Marcus Garvey said, like our elder said, let's get organized. So we came together and founded the Organization of African Doctors in 2009. We really are continuing the work of the Africans that were already there. It wasn't that many. It was maybe 10 of really, literally a handful of African people out of 4,000 students. It was literally a handful because it was a Latin American school. So we're continuing the work of Luther Castillo, who is a Garifuna brother who returned home to his community and built a hospital. So we formed the Organization of African Doctors in Cuba. And
what is the purpose?
The purpose is to create a different type of doctor. A different type of doctor, a doctor with high levels of discipline, with high levels of consciousness, high levels of dedication. And, you know, and one of our mission is we want to develop programs, projects, you know, institutions to produce these doctors and produce a group of organized doctors, politically conscious and dedicated and ready to serve the needs of African people. You know, but how we're going to do that, we're doing that through ideological training. We know we take our brothers from, we celebrate Marcus Garvey Day. We celebrate Malcolm X Day and the Coconut Revolution, just to come together and unite all these philosophies and doctrines that we have so we can develop a consciousness, a different type of consciousness in these doctors. You know, we represent the unification of African students and professionals of medicine all throughout the world, you know. And
so what is it that you guys have done as of to write today, practically?
Okay, well, practically today, well, if you look at our objectives, you will see what we're doing. Our objectives, first of all, is unification. So the first thing we're doing are uniting African people. That's the first thing we're doing. We're uniting all of the African people and oppressed people in this school and all throughout the world, because it's not just a local organization, it's an international organization. We're uniting African people. Another objective of ours is develop consciousness. And we've been working hard to develop a different doctrine, new doctrine, a new philosophy that unites all of our people and helps help the medical students to identify the complexity of the problems that African people suffer today, of the healthcare problem. Trainings, we have been doing so many trainings, just, three or four times a week training, just, going in the community, using the Cuban model to develop a different type of doctor, you know, a high level of dedication and services to the people.
Right, you already said that. So I'm saying, what makes you a revolutionary doctor and not just somebody who is just a armchair revolutionary doctor? I mean, when or are you planning to take this revolutionary ideologies that you guys are studying and take them into the community, and what's the plan?
Okay, what the plan is to, like we said, build project programs and institutions. For example, this summer, what we want to do, if we look at a historical analysis of African people, what's going on today? Let's go back, pre-colonial times. Imperialism, colonialism came to Africa, stole natural resources from Africa, but also they stole the human resource from Africa. They stole us from Africa. So Africa, we're lacking human resources. So the human resources were stolen from Africa, and what we want to do is return these human resources back to Africa. Today we have a problem in Africa. We had a brain drain. For example, we take Ghana. Many doctors are studying in Ghana, and then what they do? They leave Ghana. Or like Kwame Nkrumah say, the African is leaving and going to the colony country for example, the people in Angola are going to Portugal to study, or to Portugal to use their expertise. The people in Guinea are going to France to use their expertise. What are we doing? We're returning human resources back to Africa. And that's what brings me to the Ya Santua Brigade that we formed and went to Ghana this last summer. We had the first returning of African of natural resource of human resources back to Africa. The Ya Santua Brigade was started, and it was composed of 12 medical students who returned home to Africa, returned home to Ghana. And basically return the human resources home back to Africa. There were Cuban doctors, there were African doctors, Ghanaian doctors, medical students, traditional healers. They all returned home to this community. This summer we had African doctors and Cuban doctors and African medical students that are studying in Cuba today returned to Suriname. And to African community in Suriname, they call it the interior, and they return home there, you know? A group of disciplined, conscious, dedicated medical students and doctors return home to Suriname. In December, we will have a group of African students that will go to Brazil. So what are we doing? We're returning African students, we're returning the human resource back to Africa. Back to African communities, back to the African community. We put the African doctor back in the African community, and not just taking the African doctor and put him in Europe or put him in the European community to make a lot of money.
Well, thank you for being with us, brother. Thank you.
So one more thing I want to say is what I'm saying is I need help. I need financial help from the community. Anybody that would like to, you know, support it financially, I would like them to call me. My number is 770-465-3567, 770-465-3567, or you can donate on PayPal. You can send it to my email, which is my name, akudada@gmail.com. So.
Right on. Well, thank you, Brother Aku, for being with us, brother.
I appreciate that, bro.
All right. You were just listening to the voice of Aku Dada, the founder of the Organization of African Doctors, as well as a third-year student at the Latin American School of Medicine, right here on the Morning Mix with the Minister of Information, J.R. Thanks to Ankh Marketing, we have a few more tickets for our listeners. This Saturday at Yoshi's in Oakland, there is an 8 p.m. show and a 10 p.m. show for the great Amel LaRue. We have a pair of tickets if you would like to win and come hang out with her, 510-848-4425. Also, if you would like to see the Nappy Roots tonight in San Francisco at Yoshi's, the phone number is 510-848-4425. We only have one pair for each. So, we just, you know, I wanted to get into a little bit of local music. We've been playing a lot of Dead Prez, Gil Scott-Heron, but we've been neglecting our own political rap scene. So I had to dig in the crates and bring the first cool single to the airwaves.
So read the communist manifesto. Gorillas in the midst of devouring Evanesco. So
what about it with an afro now?
Y'all know a flow for the Mac. And we the hoes so grow, cause the Lucian brothers might get hung. Rhetoric flowing from the tip of my mouth. Say tongue deficit.
Money spent
on
my nine as they cut welfare 25%.
And I dissent as I clench and raise my
fist. We did away with that.
So you could get with this. It's a twist cause we're overthrow like Kwame Nkrumah. Spread around the world as if it were a business. This room a band, cut the record like a surgeon, cut the tumor from a brain.
We're up to dust, so feel the pain.
From 400 years of exploitation, anesthesia provided by your local TV station. Patience is not a virtue.
I ain't waiting, turn it
over like push, did a boat full of hate.
Dig it, 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 dig it.
Kind of like they trap ground with the situation.
Won't get no calluses,
cause it's written dialectical analysis. So how is this we never had no funk? Until you found out that our funk's a revolutionary, huh? Bump you over like dominoes, rat.
So free Geronimo, you jack a prick.
Lyric, 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 ain't generic. Got a sample, didn't clear it. Point one says, 5-0, that's the spirit. Cheer it. Fat out the fact that I consumed, knew that I was doomed since my day to birth to be the wretched of the earth. Never had a dream that was American.
Disparaging. That ain't nothing new.
Told the streets where they would go. Whoever paved that
got minimum wage.
Dig it, dig it, dig it, dig it.
We are back on the Morning Mix. This is the Minister of Information, JR. We are going to open up the phone lines. The phone number is 510-848-4425. Again, that is 510-848-4425. We want you to call in and let us know what you think about the show, what's going on in the world, and all the likes. You know, one of the things that I think that we should address, that we will be addressing very soon, is the black-skinned African Libyans that are being murdered by the rebel government. And, you know, we are looking for a guest. You know, you may have remembered that we had Cynthia McKinney on not too long ago, but we're going to get a few more. She's doing a lot of traveling, so we weren't able to catch up with her, but we're going to get a few more. Again, if you would like to call in, the phone number is 510-848-4425. We have time for about two callers, so you can call in for that. But, you know, if you like the Morning Mix, if you like what's going on at KPFA, the new changes that were made to the Sunday program schedule, please contribute to KPFA because this is listener-supported radio. As you have noticed, there are no commercials. So if you like hearing about the Organization of African Doctors or the Latin American Medical School, or if you like finding out what's going on with BART, you might be one of the commuters who gets stopped in the protest and not know what's going on. That's why you have the Morning Mix, the Wednesday edition, especially with myself, who's on every Wednesday. But that's why we have KPFA and the Morning Mix, so we can catch you up on what's going on locally, regionally, and internationally. So what we're going to do now, if you want to call in, we're going to still have time for call-ins, but we're going to go to a commentary by political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
9/11 plus 10. As the 10th anniversary of 9/11 approaches, it is time to take account of its aftermath. The Iraq and Afghanistan wars waged more as acts of national rage, fueled by fear than by cold reason, have devastated two Central Asian countries, causing uncounted death among Afghan and Iraqi nationals and considerable costs for the U.S. The wars, more wars of prestige than necessity, have shattered at least two countries and driven the U.S. economy into distemper. But beyond our theories or even our suspicions, wars are fought for measurable goals and objectives. We were told that these wars would be part of the so-called global war on terror. It was designed to wipe out a non-state group, Al-Qaeda, and reduce the lure of terrorism as a tool of war. If that was the intention, things haven't really worked out so well. On 9/11, Al-Qaeda had no real global footprint beyond Afghanistan. Today, it has affiliates worldwide. Indeed, the wars gave them new life, energizing them beyond their wildest hopes. Economically, politically, ideologically, the U.S. is not in a stronger position 10 years after 9/11. An indigenous anti-imperialist activist, Zachary Running Wolf of Oakland, California, is calling for a four-day period of prayer and direct action starting on 9/11. He urges folks to boycott driving, given the centrality of oil in the planning and waging of wars for corporate gain. The Mohawk Nation in Canada has signed on to this Stop Driving campaign, and more are joining. 9/11, remembered another way. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Last but not least, I want to thank everybody who contributed to today's morning mix, Kirsten Thomas, also Allison Johns. And last but not least, we're going to give away 5 pairs of tickets. Last week I was at the One Love, One Heart Reggae Festival, and it was live. If you missed it and you won tickets, it was live. This week we're going to be in Tulare County at the Allensworth Music Festival. We're giving away 5 pairs of tickets. It's the Scat to Rap Music Festival, and it will include all genres of African music, including gospel, reggae, spoken word, and it's in Allensworth. If you would like to win tickets or if you would like to carpool, you can call right now, 510-848-4425. It's in Tulare County. It's the first black city that was organized by a black man in California, and that's Colonel Allensworth. So please call in. Please tune in tomorrow to the Morning Mix with Andres and Anita of Hard Knock Radio. And until next time, this is the Minister of Information, JR, signing off until next Wednesday. If you would like to hear more from me, blockreportradio.com. We out.
This is a listing of upcoming events in the Bay Area for the week ending September 18th. All events are wheelchair accessible. Please listen closely for contact numbers. From now until September 30th, the Institute of Classical Homeopathy is accepting applications to its training program for the 2011 to 2012 academic year. The Institute is located at 2325 3rd Street in San Francisco. For details, call 415-244-5143. On Saturday, September 17th at 8 p.m., Armenian artist Gohar Vardanyan will present a guitar concert at West Valley College, 1400 Fruitvale Avenue, Saratoga. $20 admission, $15 for West Valley students. For details, call 408-292-0704. On Saturday, September 17th, from 2 to 4 p.m., the Tony Award-winning San Francisco Mime Troupe presents 2012 The Musical. This free play takes place at Willard Park, 2727 Hillegas Avenue in Berkeley. For details, call 415-285-1717. The community calendar is produced by members of the First Voice Apprenticeship Program. Send your listing at least 3 weeks in advance to KPFA Box 51, 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way in Berkeley, California, 94704. Fax them to 510-848-3812 or email us at calendar@kpfa.org. Tell us if your event is wheelchair accessible. To hear this calendar again, call 510-848-6767, extension 621. This calendar is also online at kpfa.org.
Tuned to 94.1 KPFA.